It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. When it comes to crime in Wisconsin, it turns out that most of us feel relatively safe.
But according to the latest Marquette University Law School poll released last month, Wisconsinites don't agree on how to respond to crime or on how to handle criminals.
Our next guest helped devise the poll questions, and he joins us to explain where we stand on crime and punishment.
Darren Wheelock is an associate professor of social and cultural sciences at Marquette University. Darren, thanks for being with us.
Hello and good afternoon.
Could you talk a little bit about what this poll looked at in terms of the justice system?
Sure. My collaborator and I, Michael O'Hare, we looked at a number of items concerning Wisconsin residents' views of truth in sentencing specifically, but also general notions of the desire to punish, also other views concerning rehabilitation and support for those types of programs.
And what did you find in terms of just general beliefs that people held?
Well, we found a number of pretty interesting things. We found that Wisconsinites in general are fairly supportive of truth in sentencing, and we found that at the same time, they also are pretty supportive of certain rehabilitation programs and in some cases even early release programs, which may seem to be contradictory to what truth in sentencing policies are really about.
Did anything surprise you in this study?
Some things. Certainly, one of the findings that Michael and I are still trying to better understand is that specific seeming inconsistency and what is fueling that and what types of views help explain why it is that Wisconsin residents view criminal justice policy in such complicated ways.
Well, it sounds as though, in terms of repeat offenders, people want more toughness. Is that right?
Well, I think in many ways, the respondents in our study are supportive of the notion that when people are convicted of crimes, they should serve their sentence. But that is complicated. I think that's more of how people understand truth in sentencing a bit more symbolically, because when you start then asking about specifics of policies and more practical concerns with that type of penal approach, that's where you start getting the inconsistencies.
Now, when you're talking about truth in sentencing, you're talking about serving the amount of time that you're handed down initially.
That is correct. The current statutes in the state that require that convicted inmates serve the vast majority of their time.
And what about good behavior? People serve part of their sentence, they're behaving well, they're doing everything they should. How do Wisconsinites feel about that?
Interestingly, they're fairly supportive of that, which, again, is seemingly contradictory. We think that there's a lot to that. But Wisconsinites generally favor early release programs for individuals, especially for individuals that have proven themselves to have made efforts towards rehabilitation.
So in general, let's talk about rehabilitation programs. There's data about those that work and those that don't work, and we're still divided about the best policy and the best way to get at that. But what do people feel in general about rehabilitation programs?
In general, people are supportive of providing work opportunities, of providing educational opportunities, of engaging in certain types of practices that would increase the likelihood of success when people are released. And that's not completely surprising, given I think that's a bit of a direction that nationally people are also tending to go, besides just Wisconsin residents.
Now, prisons have been a bit in the national news lately, in particular with the California prison hunger strike. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't too long ago that the system was going to consider force feeding these inmates, and this was in response to solitary confinement. In terms of solitary confinement in here in Wisconsin and treatments like that, do you have a sense of how that's regarded?
Well, we actually did not include any questions concerning solitary confinement or other punishments within prison themselves. That wasn't a focus of the study. So I'm not, I couldn't really comment specifically on that aspect of prisons.
Well, what about the death penalty?
Well, now we did find, we did include a question about support for capital punishment. And on that question, Wisconsin residents seemed to be fairly split, almost 50-50, which, again, is interesting. It seems to, it definitely tends to mirror the nationwide pattern that support for capital punishment is diminishing. Recently, there was, well, in the not-too-distant past, there was the Wisconsin referendum on the ballot that passed with a majority, and I believe the majority was about 55-56%. So it's down from there. But that question was worded a bit differently on the ballot, invoking DNA evidence, and the question that we had did not discuss DNA evidence.
And what do people say should be done about the prison system in general? We hear a lot about reform. Does that seem to be the consensus that things need to change, or is the status quo working?
That's an interesting question. It's actually a good question. I think in terms of our survey, we didn't get the strong sense that people wanted to see a change per se. What we really got was the sense that there's these, that while people supported truth in sentencing in the abstract sense, the support for that type of penal approach in the practical sense is starting to shift. And so the extent to which that means people actually want to see a reform of the criminal justice system is definitely up for debate. But it does seem like there are definitely an undercurrent of sentiments that the current system isn't quite matching what people are thinking about in terms of practical policies with regards to the criminal justice system.
Now, in terms of this poll, did it stack up against what you're seeing nationally? Do you have a sense of that?
Yes, it did in many ways. It mirrored not only what we're seeing nationally, but it also is very similar to a poll that was conducted last year that had many similar questions, not exactly the same, but very similar. So we both saw consistency across Wisconsin, but we're also seeing some consistency across the country more generally. You know, we are seeing people that the lock them up and throw away the key mentality is definitely starting to shift, and I think we're starting to see some related shifts in penal policy as well.
Okay, well, Darren, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Mm-hmm. That was Darren Wheelock, associate professor at Marquette University.
And coming up, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is asking for 100 new police officers to be put onto the city streets there. We'll be talking with a Milwaukee City Council member about why they hope it'll address a recent uptake in crime. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
Milwaukee has seen a spike of shootings in recent weeks, and though some neighborhoods are now seeing an increased police presence, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says more officers are needed on the streets.
He wants to hire 100 new police officers as part of his 2014 budget, and this is in addition to 50 new officers already being hired using federal stimulus funds. And we want to hear from you during this segment. What do you think about this idea? What do you think will help reduce crime in Milwaukee? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
Joining us right now to talk about the proposal and some of the issues facing the city of Milwaukee is Terry Wiskowski, an alderman for the city of Milwaukee, also chairman of the Public Safety Committee for the Milwaukee Common Council. In addition to all of that, he was a longtime safety director for the Milwaukee Safety Commission and Milwaukee Police Department. Terry Wiskowski, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you along. And one of the questions I have right off the top is, you know, we've been reading a lot of news stories in the last couple of weeks about an uptick in shootings in Milwaukee. And is that what most of the crime is we're talking about, or is that most of the crime that's just getting the attention?
I believe that's the crime getting the attention at this point in time. Is this normal? No. Is it a grouping that would cause concern? Yes.
And so Mayor Barrett is proposing this addition of 100 brand new officers on the street. Is this something that you support?
Well, I don't have the facts behind it yet. This is a proposal for the 2014 budget. The mayor does a really great job of preparing good budgets for the city of Milwaukee. They start in February, and he will eventually get done working with department heads and the budget director in September and deliver that budget to the council to deliberate on. We, in turn, will have hearings bringing in each of the departments to make their case for what their proposed budget is. And, of course, there is a cap on what we can spend. We have a history here. We've gone from 11,000 employees down to 7,000 employees over the past 24 years with diminishing the size of government in each of those years. But we don't have endless funds, and there is a cap, and we have to live within our means. And it really amounts to, at this point in time, is this a valid proposal? Can we sustain this proposal? Can we afford it? What do we have to cut in order to add 100 officers? This is $4.5 million we're talking about.
So you've still got some concerns about that particular proposal. In terms of addressing some of the crime issues facing Milwaukee, though, do you have some other things that you would like to see the mayor or the council consider, other initiatives that you think might be helpful?
Well, if you talk to the 15 members of the Common Council, I think you'll find that many of them have different thoughts on how to address crime in Milwaukee. Yes, law enforcement is the main way, and it's the way that everybody sees. But to get down to the root causes of crime in Milwaukee, what can we do not only to get rid of a spike today, but prepare for the future and make sure that we don't have crime in the future? Each of the aldermen would have their opinion.
You know, earlier this week, go ahead.
From my perspective, if you look at a lot of the things that go on with shootings in Milwaukee, you've got a couple of things that work here. You do have drugs being sold. You do have gangs involved in selling drugs. You do have problems between different people that are in that business. We do have a problem with people buying it, obviously, and they're not necessarily city residents. They are, but they aren't as well. I would like to take a deeper look at what other alternatives do we have besides lock them up to dealing with the drug problem. We've had a war on drugs in this country since the 60s. Obviously, it hasn't worked. The problem still exists. Matter of fact, it's international with both gangs and drugs at this point in time. So I would like to look at what programs work, either from a judicial standpoint or from an education standpoint, a behavioral standpoint. How can we change people's behavior? If you look at what's happened with smoking in this country, we've gone from, probably the 1970s, large no smoking campaigns to reducing smokers to about 22% of the population in making healthier people and keeping health costs down. If you look at drunk driving, when MAD came along in the early 80s, that changed the attitude of how we treat drunk driving in the country, and we actually started to address the problem and have reduced the problem over the years. So can we take a look at drugs the same way? Are there effective programs out there that might be hitting a small number of people that can be expanded to larger numbers? You have to look down the road a piece as to what can we do today to affect tomorrow, not only what can we do to affect this spike.
And I understand also that you believe that the foreclosure crisis is a contributor to some of the issues that you're seeing in Milwaukee.
Well, it is. Obviously, it provides a safe haven for drug dealers if they can get the house open. It also adds to our crime statistics because we do have scrappers that go in and strip the house, making it virtually worthless. And it's just adding to the statistics as well as taking away property value in Milwaukee. we'd be better off with no house sitting there, no building, no lead problem, if the house wasn't there. I'm very sorry that the monies received for the housing crisis did not get passed along to deal with this problem.
Now, statewide, we're seeing a lot of headlines about this, particularly in light of a visit to Milwaukee earlier this week by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who toured part of the city. And, you know, he says he supports the mayor's effort to increase police presence there in some respects, but he also cautions that the city shouldn't be counting on additional state funding. And then, of course, Mayor Barrett showed up at that visit, and it turned into an interesting visit and all of that. And I'm wondering a couple of things. First of all, what role is politics playing in all of this? Because on the one hand, there's a crime issue here, whether you're talking about shootings or some of the other issues that you'd have identified. On the other hand, you've also got the state dollars that may or may not be involved. You've got the dollars you've talked about in Milwaukee, and now you've got politicians right in the middle of it.
Yeah, and I would think that what's the show that's going on there is more political. It unfortunately, the 600,000 people in Milwaukee suffer because of political problems in Madison. We've had our shared revenue cut. We've had police funding cut. Just numerous different cuts that have hurt us. Even when it comes to tipping fees and reducing the amount of stuff going into a landfill, it costs us more. The state taxes us on that, charges us a fee, yet doesn't put out penny one. It doesn't cost the state money for the landfill, but we're the ones that are penalized. So we've been penalized along the way here. So is this political? Yes, it is.
Let's take a call right now, and Heather joins us from Winona, Minnesota.
Hi. I'm a graduate from Winona State in criminal justice law enforcement, and I just completed 2 years of AmeriCorps doing social and emotional development of 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds. And I'm in Winona, but I get the Cooley Region news, and the state of Wisconsin just cut funding for early childhood education. And yes, granted, you would like to have more police out there, but, you know, crime starts when there's no jobs. And if there's no jobs, why does that happen? Because they're not educated. So learning what I learned from even helping little kids, getting these guys self-regulated and ready for kindergarten is essential to these children continuing education later in their lives. And, you know, it's not just a political or the senators or legislators. It's a community-based effort. So, you know, if I look up my street right now, I see nobody outside. Where is everybody? They're inside their houses by themselves, not being a part of the bigger community. I think we've become very sheltered, and we just depend on politicians and senators and people that we don't even know to run our lives. And
well, Heather, thanks so much for the call. Alderman Witkowski, and I apologize for the various pronunciations of your name here. I'm really screwing it up badly, but I'm going to try to get through this. Heather brings up an interesting point, and I'm wondering when you listen to her talk about, you know, education and working with young people, what are your constituents saying to you about all of this? I mean, you see it as a problem, of course, from your vantage point on the city council. But as constituents talk to you, as they outline what they're seeing there, what are their concerns?
Well, my district, I have 44,000 people in my district. There's 15 aldermen in the city. We hear different things. In my case, crime is not a large concern. I have an area of the city that is not experiencing these problems. So I'm really not hearing much on it. However, your caller makes a good point with early childhood education. It's been proven to help children to be more successful in school. And, of course, if they have an education, they're more likely to get jobs. It all follows. I mentioned before that if you talk to different aldermen, you'd get different solutions. Yes, jobs are part of the equations. There is a group trying to work on black male unemployment, which is a problem. There's a group working on black male fatherhood, which is a problem. I mentioned the lead problem. There was just a study released that showed that children tested positive for lead in their system by age 4 have a 33% chance of being suspended, or actually the records show that 33% of them have been suspended in school by third grade.
So lots and lots to think about. Alderman, I'm afraid we are out of time, but thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Alderman Terry Witkowski. He is the chairman of the Public Safety Committee for the Milwaukee Common Council.
And you can let us know what you think about adding more police officers to help fight crime in the city of Milwaukee at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We've been talking about Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett's proposal to add 100 new police officers to the streets to help address crime in the city, and wondering about the efficacy of initiatives like this. Do they work?
Martin Floss is with us right now. He is the chair of the graduate program in criminal justice administration at Hilbert College in Hamburg, New York. Martin, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
As we mentioned, we were talking about a proposal in the city of Milwaukee to add 100 new police officers to the street. And it's sort of the centerpiece of the mayor's proposal there to fight what they see as a spike in crime. And the question, I guess the big question is that in and of itself enough?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, but probably a pretty complicated answer to go along with it. And I say that because, well, first, you know, we have brave and dedicated men and women all over the country who, you know, work hard every day at fighting crime as law enforcement. So to hire 100, police officers, I don't think is ever a bad idea. They do lots of great work in many of all of our communities. With that being said, I think intuitively, the police officer as crime fighter would lend us to think that they would successfully reduce crime. There's more police officers, and they can, do a good job at accomplishing that. On the other hand, I think what would likely happen, and is not as intuitive, is that you could see actually crime go up. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The reason why I say that is we typically measure crime by the number of arrests. And if you have more police officers on the street that are working hard, they're likely to find and catch more than otherwise would have been caught. And so, interestingly, you may see crime go up, but it's really not a great indicator of what's going on in the community, because that means they've just caught more people that they otherwise wouldn't have. So, an analogy that I have, if you put more bakers in a donut shop, you get more donuts. Police officers don't make donuts, they make arrests. So if you have more on the street, they're going to be working hard, and they're going to catch more people doing bad things. So on paper, it may look like crime has gone up, when that's really not the case. You've just found and uncovered more. Now, I would also say that, without doubt, you will make people in the neighborhoods feel more safe, and there will be lots of other things that police officers do that is going to make things better. So I would say it's an interesting question, but not as straightforward of an answer as you might think.
Is it a question that other cities have faced and then answered in this way, by putting more officers on the street? And if so, the scenarios that you've outlined, more arrest, crime rate going up, have those materialized?
Well, I would say that, in response to drastically falling crime all across the United States for a very long time, which, by the way, most of your viewers probably don't realize. Since 1990, particularly 1992, crime has gone down precipitously in all categories, particularly violent crime, to near historic lows. So, you know, now, you know, they can only go so low, and who knows where that point is. And at some point, they're going to probably go up. And that's, you know, regardless of what the many fine men and women do in law enforcement. So we've had, you know, cities across the country, the most notable, New York, Commissioner Kelly and folks saying that they reduced homicide by 50% by dealing with a new approach to crime fighting and dealing with the quality of life crimes. But I've really not, I wouldn't be willing to give them full credit for that because that same decrease went down in communities across the nation. So to say that they were responsible for that, I would say probably not all of it. But if crime goes up, I would also say that they're not responsible for it going up either. So, you know, the fact that crime has gone down and police officers have looked very good has also, I believe, you know, had some communities, you know, use some of their funding in other directions. But you can't keep taking from that. I think if you don't support the police department, that especially now that crime is so low, that the media will start reporting percent increases and not give the full story, and that would be very alarming to the citizens.
If you had an opportunity to sit down with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and give him some advice about these 100 police officers, what would you suggest to him that they might do, assuming that, you know, there's the money there to pay them and they wind up out on the streets? I mean, it seems to me that it's more than just police officers being out there, that there has to be some community buy-in as well.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So I would talk about how the mayor plans and the police chief or commissioner plans on using those folks. Oftentimes, you have people using tactical units, and that, too, can be a tricky situation. For example, I believe, and I'm not sure I represent all people in my field, however, if you have, let's say, a high drug area, and you go in tactically and take out those responsible, most people are going to say that's great, and obviously that would be a good thing. On the other hand, I've often cautioned police executives not to just do that and move on to the next drug hotspot, because in my view, you may actually see a rise in violence in that same area that you just cleaned out. So you need to keep people there to keep that place clean, if you will, because if not, now you have other people that are going to vie and fight and be violent to take over that that drug market that you, because of your policing, you know, took the head of it out. So in the short run, that too may seem like a very intuitive and appropriate approach. But without some longstanding, you know, dedication to that area, you may actually see, you know, violent crime as new gangs or other people move in to take over that the drug dealing in that place. You may find violence to actually go up in the short run. So I think that there's been lots of policing efforts that have shown to be very effective. The Boston Gun Project has been heralded at reducing all kinds of bad behaviors, particularly with gangs. And so I would say if you're going to use 100 officers, use them wisely and think things through.
And that's all sometimes hard to do in the heat of politics.
Absolutely, because so often it's not as intuitive. For example, people often want everybody on foot patrol. But that's not a very effective use of resources often. It certainly, in some areas, is a great approach. In others, if, you know, houses are far apart and things of that nature, it's not as effective. And there's research to show that people feel more safe with foot patrol, and if the police officer knows their name and they know the police officer's name. But on the other hand, some of that same research has shown that the people were at the very same risk of being a victim. So it didn't protect them, it just made them feel better. And that may very well be a political question.
Well, I know that you have to go, but thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, and have a great day.
That was Martin Floss. He is chair of the Graduate Program in Criminal Justice Administration at Hilbert College in Hamburg, New York.
Coming up, we'll learn about the new mammal that scientists recently identified, and I have to say, it's pretty darn cute.
Pretty darn cute.
And there's also a picture of it up on the Central Times
Facebook
page.
Pretty darn cute. That's all we're saying.
We can't stress it enough, apparently. We'll talk with one of the researchers involved in its discovery coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last week, the Smithsonian announced that it had found the first new carnivorous mammal to be discovered in the Americas in 35 years.
That animal is called the olenguito. It's related to the raccoon, and it lives in the cloud forests of Ecuador.
And here to talk about this new animal is Roland Kays, one of the researchers who worked on the team that discovered the new mammal. He's the director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and professor of North Carolina State University. Thanks for being with us, Roland.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's meet this olenguito. What kind of animal is it?
Yeah, well, the olenguito, I guess the first word that comes out is cute. It is a pretty cute critter. It's furry. It's got big eyes and a long, super fluffy tail. And it kind of looks like a red panda, if you have to pick one species that people may be a little more familiar with. It is reddish. In fact, that's one of the things that distinguishes it from the other olenguitos, is it is it's reddish, darker, and has this really long fur.
Now, I have to interrupt here by saying, as I understand it, the olenguito has been there all along, and so he's not been discovered so much as just sort of found.
Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't create this guy in a laboratory or anything. He's been living in the forest for millions of years, and he's been overlooked. He's been completely missed quite a bit, but he did show up a couple times. In fact, our discovery started not in the forest, but in the museum, working in the behind the scenes in museum collections, just looking through skulls and skeletons of olenguitos. We were trying to figure out how many olenguitos there were, and the lead author on the project, Chris Helgen, was going through these drawers and just looking at the known olenguitos, and suddenly this red animal just popped out and was like, wow, this is different. And, no one had ever described it before. So that's kind of where the story starts.
It does beg the question, though, so how something so cute can be so missed over all these years.
So, that's true. Well, there's a lot of treasures in museums in these drawers, and a lot left to be discovered, in the museums, but also out in the natural world for sure.
So, on a more serious note, so you pull this critter out in the museum drawer, and you take a look. Where do you go next in trying to establish that this is something different, that it
right,
could be something brand new?
Well, you have to make sure you see, well, what's already out there, what's known about what's already out there, and that's the other, in this case, it's the other olenguitos, and then characterizing, well, what does this thing look like, and how is it different? And these days, that's not just looking at the teeth and the skull and the skin, but it's also doing the genetic work and trying to learn something about what the animal actually does and how it makes its living. And so that journey took us, from the sort of, dusty, dark bowels of the museums out into the cloud forest of Ecuador to look for this animal. We took the information that was on the few specimens we had. Each of these specimens in the museums has a tag that says, where it came from and when it was collected. And so we took that data to try to guess, where else might they be, and to try to see if they were still there and if we could get, some fresh samples for DNA and some more records of where they actually live, so that we could do some mapping analysis and try to figure out, what is their range, how much habitat do they use, what sort of habitat do they need, and how much is still left.
I'm guessing you were dying to get out there and see a real live olenguito. What was that like?
It was pretty cool. It was, a lot of build-up, a lot of, getting the trip ready and working with Miguel Pinto from Ecuador, who really did a masterful job at scouting a good site, and we were hopeful, but, at the same time, it was definitely a long shot. And so You know, a little bit nervous that we would go down there and not find anything. I mean, we would still, you know, learn stuff about the other mammals that's there. And, you know, the magic thing about these cloud forests is they're so special. There's so many unique animals out there that, you know, I was hopeful that even if we didn't find an Olenghito, we'd you know, our survey would turn up some other interesting mammals. And, you know, I kind of figured it'd be down to the wire the very last day. You know, we'd be staying up all night, trucking through the forest, trying to find it. But actually, the very first night, walking out on the trail, we found an Olenghito right away.
So he's right there waiting for you.
Yeah, it was. Everyone was pretty happy that night.
Well, you have to settle something for us. So the Smithsonian apparently is saying it's a carnivorous mammal.
Yeah.
I read elsewhere that it eats fruit. So is it a vegetarian or is it?
Well, it's both. So it's kind of like if your last name was carnivore, but you were a vegetarian.
Okay, so that makes no sense to me.
If your mother's name, if your last name was, it is a carnivore by name, by its heritage. It is related to the group of mammals known as the carnivores. The carnivora is the technical term that includes things like lions and tigers and weasels and wolves. And, you know, most of those animals eat meat, but not all of them do. The panda bear, you know, eats leaves. There's lots of other animals that eat things other than meat that are in this group that's known as the carnivores.
Okay, gotcha.
It's in this family of carnivores, but actually, you know, we found that up in fruiting trees, this forest was really special. I've never seen one so full of fruiting fig trees. Little green fruits, big giant red fruits the shape of tomatoes, and, you know, these trees had Olenghitos up there eating the fruit, and also, you know, a host of other animals. There were kinkajous, and there was this really cool prehensile-tailed porcupine that was climbing around. All these animals are out at night up in these trees eating these fruits. And there's more we don't know. They might be carnivorous. They might eat other things as well that we don't know about yet. You know, this is day one for the Olenghito, and there's still a lot more to learn.
So have you learned about how healthy the population is and whether they're in danger or whether they've just been overlooked all these years?
Well, again, this is day one, first cut. It doesn't look like it's super endangered. From taking the points that we know where it's been found in Colombia and Ecuador, looking at what those habitats are like and building some sort of computer models and trying to guess, well, given that this is where we know it does live or has lived sometimes in the last, say, 100 years, where else might it live? And then how many of those places still have forests versus have been converted to agriculture already? We find that it's got about 40,000 square kilometers of habitat available. So that's not a lot, but it's not sort of critical endangered. And so that's an estimate that needs to be refined with future work, but it's kind of our starting point.
Do you know anything about the Olenghito that was actually miscategorized at the Washington Zoo?
Yeah. That animal really threw us for a loop. So we got our DNA samples from all the different Olenghito species that were out there from all over South America and Central America from different museums. We ran the DNA work in the lab there at the Smithsonian and plugged all the data together. And there was this one old sample that was in a database called GenBank, which is where biologists put, you know, all the results of their genetic work. And it was labeled as an Olingo. And so we said, all right, well, let's throw this old one in there and we'll add that to our data. Well, the old one, when you suddenly have the whole framework of the whole group of Olingos, it turned out to be an Olenghito. So we said, wow, this guy, you know, talk about hiding underneath our own nose. It was already in GenBank. It was just labeled wrong. And so now we want to know more. Well, where did this sample come from? And, you know, what did this animal look like? And so we dived into the archives of the National Zoo and found the vet report of this animal. That's where it was. It was only in the National Zoo for 1 year. And it turned out this animal moved around a whole bunch. And I tracked down one of the old zookeepers who had the animal. And she had some records. And she told me that the animal originally came from the mountains of Colombia. So that's kind of cha-ching. We got one, you know, that matches with where we think these animals live. And the other amazing thing she said was that it wouldn't breed with any of the other Olingos that they had.
I wonder why.
Well, yeah, exactly. So because it was a different species. And that's sort of, you know, that's like the golden test that you would love to do when you're describing a new species, you know, kind of experiment. Well, if it doesn't breed with other animals that are similar, then they must be different. But you never actually get to do that in real life. And here someone already had done that by accident. And we were able to sort of suss this out of the old reports.
You know, this is such an interesting story. And, I mean, it has to be a thrill for you to have been a part of this. but it's gotten a lot of play, and I'm wondering what it is about this particular topic that seems to really have captured people's attention. I mean, we've all seen his picture by now, and if you haven't, it's on our webpage, and he looks very cute. We know
it to your kids.
Show it to your kids. What is it about this idea of finding something brand new that really seems to resonate with people?
Well, I think, you know, there's this idea that the world is explored, and that, you know, we're past the age of discovery, and we're into some new era, and that, you know, just the idea that something so cool, so cute, you know, so charismatic was out there and not brought to our attention. I think it raises hope that there's other things out there that you know, young scientists can go out and find. And I think that is one of the reasons that I think this story has really resonated. And I hope that those young scientists will, you know, will look especially to these cloud forests where this Olenghito was found, and especially to the tree canopies, because I think this is the frontier. We think about, you know, the unexplored, you know, outer space or the ocean floor. But I think tropical canopies, they're hard to get to. There's animals hiding up there, and there's going to be more discoveries to be made out of there in future generations.
You sound pretty excited about this. Have you ever discovered an animal like this before?
Not like this. So mammals are discovered, you know, every year or so. There's usually some more mice and bats or small little things. And I was, when I was younger, I helped a museum expedition where I actually caught the animal that turned out to be new. It was a little mouse opossum. I wasn't involved. I wasn't sort of able to figure out, you know, if it was, well, actually, we were pretty sure it was new when we caught it, but it took a lot more museum work by the senior scientists on that to work it out. So I wasn't really involved, but that was kind of fun, and that kind of gave me a taste for it, and I was really excited to be part of this team at the Smithsonian that brought the Olenghito out to the public.
So now we're early in the survey process. As we move forward, what are you hoping to learn about the Olenghito, and how will that process look?
Well, one of the processes has already started. The thing we really need to know is where else does this animal live? We've got sort of our model, our predictions of where we think it lives, but we need to conduct some surveys and see, you know, these areas that we predict it lives, does it live there? There's other areas that we think maybe might be good suitable habitat, but we don't have any records from them, and so we really need to see if they're there or not, and that could end up really increasing or decreasing the amount of area that we know they live in. And amazingly, this the press, the attention that this has gotten the Olenghito, has brought a lot of new pictures and data and information from naturalists and biologists in Colombia and Ecuador that have had pictures sometimes, you know, in their library for 10 years and not really known what it was, or just thought it was a regular Olingo. And now they're sending it to us, and we're like, yeah, that's an Olingo. In fact, we had someone who sent us a picture of a baby Olenghito.
Oh, I bet that is almost too cute.
Yeah, it was really cute. And, you know, they're like, is this the baby Olenghito? And I said, well, I've never seen a baby Olenghito, so I'm not really sure, but it looks like one. And then turns out they had a picture of an adult as well. And it was definitely, you could tell from the picture right away. And, you know, interestingly, this species, actually, we described four different subspecies, which what that means is that there's quite a lot of variability within the species. These different mountain ranges in Colombia have slight variations in color.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, Roland. I think we could talk all day about the Olenghito, but we can't. But thank you so much for joining us. We're talking with Roland Kays, director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences.
Coming up next, we take a look at the news.